It's supposed to be maculopidoptera, along with big things like silk moths and sphingid moths and geometrics and so on, but they insist that our tree is always falling lower down on the tree, and their place is taken next to the other maculops by the pyraloid moths. And these guys have always been called microlepidoptera, and they tend to be internal or concealed feeders as larvae, unlike maculops. On the other hand, unlike butterflies, they do share with most maculops the possession of paired tympanal organs along the abdomen, the size of the abdomen of the thorax, which are probably devices for detecting predators that hunt using sonar and special.
Yeah?
So they are flightless but not winged, which the muscles are affected
the wings are still. The wings are there, but the wings are strongly reduced. So we're not exactly sure if it's a reduction of musculature, a reduction of wing area, or both that's leading to the flightlessness.
What?
Pardon?
Do you know some of the
predators? The only predators historically present in those alpine areas were probably spiders, but in the, yeah. In the back? I used a geometric to root my tree because that was the closest sequence that I could find on GenBank, and I didn't have any other good outgroups at the time. I've since obtained some much better outgroups, but again, did not have time to include them in this tree.
Real ramp up in the amount of work that's being done both morphologically and molecularly in the pyraloids. This is a group that has received, has had a real paucity of work in the past, and it's really exciting to be working with a number of different collaborators on really looking at some of the evolutionary patterns that are occurring in this group. And so this is actually going to be the first molecular phylogeny of the physetines and even the pyraloids in general. And so just a broad overview here. So the pyraloidiae is a very large superfamily, which is broken up into two families. There's 16,000 described species, and of course many more undescribed. And I know pyraloids have a bit of a bum rap. They're often considered dull, drab moths, but as you can see, we actually have some very, very attractive individuals within this group. And in addition to the morphological diversity that we can see within this group, there's also a real diversity in larval life history, and this is really interesting because we can start looking at how this group is diversified into a wide range of plants as well as a wide range of feeding styles. So you can see we have things that are leaf tires, tissue miners, and the other interesting thing with this group is they are often pest species because of this mining habitat and this mining habit. And understanding how these pest species have evolved can give us insight into other groups which may become a problem in the future. So the family that I'm going to focus on here, the Pyralidae, has five subfamilies, and the largest of which is the physetines, which will be the focus of this talk. Now, a preliminary pyralid phylogeny was conducted by Alma Solis and Charlie Mitter in 1992, and we see that the physetines are sister to the epipachyines, and there are some additional groupings here, some of which are resolved, some of which are not. And I'm coming back to this and compare this to the relationships that I find within my tree. Now, in the past, physetines have been avoided by many researchers because some workers have stated that working on physetines is a vain and futile performance. They have a lot of congruent evolution in the male and female genitalia, which has made morphological classifications very difficult. And unfortunately, this has been reiterated throughout the literature. But although Heinrich did state that it was not worth exploring, he did produce this chart, really, which groups the taxa in North America into either hindwing groups, which are in the vertical groups here, and then broke those up based on larger genitalic variation. And so I'm going to compare sort of this grouping to the molecular phylogeny that I obtained for the physetines. Now, as I said, This has been reiterated throughout the literature, but Marion Horak, in a re-examination of a number of genera in 1997 and 2003, did acknowledge that with some additional work and exploring additional morphological character groups, such as sexual structures in the eighth abdominal tergum of the male, may provide hope for a morphological phylogeny, which Thomas Simonson is actually going to be presenting after me later in this session, but acknowledges that there may be need for that molecular data to help provide structure to the tree. And so I was able to sample 39 species in the pyralids, most of which were in the physotines, and then included a large number of outgroup taxa because we really don't know how those groups are related and what the sister group to the pyralids are in the crambid subfamilies. And I was able to sample both CO1 and EF1 alpha and performed a partition Bayesian analysis of this data. So again, as I had said, we have these lunation groups from Heinrich in the vertical columns, and then the genitalic groups horizontally. And the taxa highlighted in blue are ones that I had included. And these genitalic and wing groupings I will come back to in a few minutes. So, some results. So here's a large tree. I don't want you to look at it. I'm going to break this down here in a second. So here's just a summary of the subfamily relationships. You can see that the pyralids form a strongly supported monophyletic clade, which is excellent. That supports the morphological relationships that had been resolved previously. But then, you'll notice, with fairly strong resolution and strong support, the crambids form a paraphyletic group relative to the pyralids. But since these were included as my outgroups, and there are no groups outside of the pyraloids, it's difficult to say anything strongly about these relationships. Now, just going back to Solis and Mitter in 1992, you'll notice that there is a definite difference between the morphological phylogeny that had been obtained and the molecular phylogeny that we find, with the physotines forming a sister group to the galerines and the epipashiines, and then the pyralinae and the chrysogenae form a sister group, and those, again, form a monophyletic clade. And then the sister group to the pyralids are the galerines, which is a relationship that had not been resolved historically. So now let's just zoom into the tree a little more. We're going to focus on the physotines. Now, rather than focusing really on the names here, just sort of focus on the larger groups. And we'll notice at the base of the tree, there's really short branches and very little support for these relationships. And this actually was kind of surprising because I would have expected that the relationships at the base of the tree to have been the ones would have been the ones causing the most problem. But rather, it was within the tree here that the resolution had failed, or the data was not available to provide resolution. Now, if we look at the historical classification of the physotines, we can see that there definitely is some work that is needed. So the groups within the physotine, so this is the tribal classification, based on Matthias Nuss's Globus Pyraloid database, which if you've never checked out is really, if you're interested in pyraloids, it's definitely a very interesting clearinghouse for all pyraloid information. And you'll notice that we have a really broken up tribe of physotines, but more interestingly, we have the other tribe nested within members of the physotiny clade, so the Anserini nest within this, suggesting we really need to focus our collecting on this other tribe to figure out how this tribal relationship falls apart. This also suggests that some major revision is going to be needed of the group in the future. So now let's go back to that chart that Heinrich had put together. We'll first just look at the wing venation groups. And you'll notice, focus on the sort of hindwing venation here. So we have a hindwing with the M2 and the M3 vein present. And we'll notice it generally sort of falls into this clade right here, with the exception of this individual down here. While the hindwing M2, M3, or with a single M2, M3 vein forming this larger basal clade, which It does suggest that there is signal from the morphological characters. There just may be some homoplasy present. So if we look at the genitalia, we also notice that his groups do sort of form, do conform sort of to the relationships that we found within the phylogeny, and with some exceptions. And so what we can take from this is that there is hope for the morphological characters, and that the molecular data is providing insight to help score and understand how these morphological characters are evolving. And one thing I want to point out, as I mentioned before, those sexual structures on the male abdomen 8, you'll see at the base of the tree here, we start with these really puffy, undifferentiated structures, these scale brushes, but as you move up the tree, you get to these very complex, very differentiated and grouped scale brushes. And so there may be some very interesting questions to ask about these sexual structures and how they evolve within the physotime. And now another interesting avenue is how the physotime's feeding characteristics have evolved. And so we started by looking at the type of feeding. So if you look at the base of the tree, most of the larvae are tissue miners. They live internally within the tissue. But as you move up the tree, you actually notice we have an open feeding or leaf tying habit. And so again, this is where getting more information of the larval history can help provide insight in how this group has evolved. Unfortunately, this is less of a trend, but you'll notice the base of the tree, many of our groups are very polyphagous, and then up at the top of the tree, we have a more narrow-focused larval feeding guild. But again, more information will be needed to get a better idea of how these traits are evolving. So, in general, things are exciting in the pyraloids. We're finding some really interesting results. The pyralids are monophyletic, and we'll have to get some more data to understand where the crambids are falling out. The subfamilies are monophyletic, and that additional work is going to be needed in the classification, as well as getting more morphological and larval history to understand the evolution of this group. And some acknowledgments, and I'm done.
Thank you. I've got time for one quick question.
Oh, whoops.
Get out of here. All right.
James.
Do you have a plan to sample the taxa out? Are you prioritizing the taxa or foliage?
Yeah, the question was whether we have a taxon sampling plan focusing on other groups. Well, this was just a shotgun sampling. We hadn't done anything yet. The focus is going to be trying to get other groups from beyond North America. So these taxa were North American alone. We really need to get into Australia, into Africa, and pretty much all over the world to get some of these other diversifications, just to get a sense of where things are evolving. Because we know so little about the tribal classifications within the physotime, we have to pretty much sample very broadly to help figure out where the lineages are.
Bulk structures provide a number of characters very useful for species separation. Now, the situation in the systematics of Noctuidae with bulk structures is different. Volvite structures are much less intensively used in for phylogenetical analysis compared to other male genital characters, and volvite structures are of limited use in systematics because of difficulties of homology assessment for structures found in different groups. So why is this difficult exist? What causes the difficulties? First of all, the main problem which causes all other problems is lack of research on homology of volvite structures. Lack of research consequentially causes lack of knowledge of what different volvite structures actually are and what are they derived from. And this lack of knowledge is reflected in definitions that we have for volvite structures, and most of definitions refer not to a particular ancestral structure, but rather to a particular topographic region of vulva. And such definitions do not help to assess homologies. Finally, all these problems causes confusion in using terms when the same term is applied to non-homologous structures or different terms are used for the same structure. This genital capsule of representative of the clade that includes subfamilies Xylinina, Noctuina and Gadenina of Triphine Noctuis. Or this clade also known as Noctuina in broad sense. Let's take a look at one of vulva and found the main vulval structure. For some of these structures, more terms are available. In addition, there is one more structure, a membrane that occupies the centroproximal part of vulva and known as annulifer. That actually is not part of vulva, but an extension of the diaphragm of nine abdominal segment. In Triphine noctuids, there usually are no big problems with homology assessment, in most cases. Most often modifications are changes in size, shape, or proportions, reduction of some of structures, or their fusion. Real problem exists in quadrifine noctuidae. Take a look and find the clasp. So, how to find it? How to find the clasp? We know that in vulva of Detrizian Lepidoptera, in most groups of Detrizian Lepidoptera, vulva have intrinsic muscle, which originates and inserts within vulva. In a Triphine noctuidae, this muscle is inserted in most cases on clasp, as you can see on this picture. So it is assumed that if we know place where this muscle inserts in the quadrifine noctuidae, we can find the structure which is homologous to clasp. This assumption may be misleading. Here are three representatives of the subfamily Catocalinae. Well, they are quite different, but we can find some homologous structures. First, costa. Second, continuous sclerotization extended from the distal end of sacculus to the costa. And third, a projection arising from the place where distal end of sacculus meets with this continual sclerotization. We call this sclerotization midvulval sclerotization. So now let's see where intrinsic muscle is inserted. In the first species, it is inserted on the base of costa, and costa is movable by constriction of this muscle. In second species, it is inserted right in the middle of the midvulval sclerotization, and in third species, it is inserted on the base of this projection. This projection is often referred as saccular extension. And saccular extension is movable by constriction of this muscle. So, in this particular case, the place of the insertion of intrinsic muscle cannot be used to assess homology of clasper. Then, how to find it? Probably to find the cluster, we have to know what is it, what is it derived from, and as well as what all other vulval structures are derived from. Maybe we have to start with answering to the question, what is the vulva, what is it derived from? It is not very difficult to answer this question because most researchers agree that valva of Lepidoptera derived from either homologous to gonopods or to gonopod. And we know that presomorphic condition for gonopods is two-segmented condition. How about Lepidoptera? Valva of all Lepidoptera are assumed to be one-segmented. This assumption actually is not always correct, at least in Detrisia. And there are structures which derived from the first gonopodal segment, the gonococcyte, and are structures derived from the second gonopodal segment, the gonostylus. Let's take a look at the valva of Meropleon ambifuscum. Here is the membrane known as annelifer, which is an extension of the diaphragm of nine abdominal segments. We think that this membrane may be homologous to the membrane that connects the base of the first gonopodal segment, the gonococcyte, with the body wall. Then structures to which annelifer is attached would be parts of the gonococcyte, and such structures are facculus, costa, and clasper. In addition to these structures, digitus may be added to these structures since it is just a terminal projection of costa. These structures, together with the basal part of outer wall of valva, make a sclerotized ring which we consider to be homologous with the first gonopodal segment, the gonococcyte. Here our views on the division of valva into gonococcal and gonostylar compartments are shown. And we consider cuculus and valvula to be parts derived from the second gonopodal segment, the gonostyle. Then, what is clasper? Clasper is nothing more but just a posterior part of the gonococcyte.